This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And once again, on Fridays at 9 o'clock in the morning, we bring a program of discussion with someone who really knows something about something and can explain it to the rest of us. And rather than go into politics or economics or social problems or even cultural issues, I thought it would be really interesting and important to move to a topic of science because it is so interesting and important to the rest of us. And my attention was attracted to a story in a number of media houses, but most the one I saw first was in The Economist. And let me just quote from it just for a minute. It says, genetically, human beings are remarkably similar. Some 99.6% of your genome, that's each of you, obviously, the unique string of DNA located in a body's cells is the same. Even the remaining differences are common. More than 95% of the different bits will be shared by tens of millions of others. But tiny variations can have important consequences for susceptibility to disease. So a well-stocked genomic library can be used by scientists to study different genetic identities. Such research can also help patients to better understand the function of their own genes and demand better treatment. An international consortium of researchers has now created such a pan-genome. Each genome was painstakingly assembled from DNA fragments taken from blood samples. A digital file now contains the genome sequences of 47 people, and some 300 more will soon be added, including from underrepresented regions such as the Middle East. Genetic diversity will help scientists understand how mutations arise across space as well as time. And our guest today, to help us understand all that and make it clear to everybody, Professor Michelle Ramsey, who is the director of the WITS University of the Witwatersrand, for those of you who aren't in Johannesburg, the WITS Sydney Brenner Institute for Molecular Bioscience. She's a professor in human genetics and a South African research chair in genomics and bioinformatics of African populations. How in the world do you have time to do any of that? All of it? Anything else? Her personal research centers on the question, why are some people more susceptible to developing disease than others? As a human geneticist, she explores genetic variation in African populations and seeks to understand gene-to-gene and gene-to-environment interactions that influence disease risk. Welcome, and thank you very much for joining us to help explain and unpack the implications of this astonishing development.
Thank you so much, Brooks, and hello, and a topic that is so close to my heart that I'm very happy to be talking about human genomes and specifically human genomes in Africa.
Let me start by asking you why this study and this process is important for medicine. I mean, we say it is, but why is it? Why is it going to help with a better understanding of human evolution? And does it have any connection to the African Eve idea? And why so many differences occur among African populations in that small percentage of variation rather than all the rest of the world? And maybe, in fact, what is DNA and why does it matter to inheritance? That's a lot. We have about 6 hours. We can do all this.
Those are a lot of questions for sure. And, you know, you're making me think back to the start of the Human Genome Project, which was in the 1990s, and, you know, very happy to have been part of that in a small bit. But it's literally 2 decades since we published the first reference sequence of a human genome. And we've come so far in 20 years, and it's extraordinary that we now have this more nuanced and much more detailed map of the human genome. So maybe for the listeners to go back to, you know, what is DNA? What is a genome? So the genome is really the blueprint that has all the information to make all the proteins in our bodies that make up our cells and make us function as humans. And the extraordinary thing is that the vocabulary and the alphabet for this genome is literally four letters. It's called A, C, G, and T. And those are repeated again and again in different orders. And they are like a code that makes up words, which are then the genes. And the genes encode the proteins, and that those are the building blocks of our cells. What is really interesting is that, you know, two decades ago when we had that first reference sequence, is that that was made up 70% from one specific individual and a few other people mixed in. But what it was sort of a linear sequence that it took the chromosomes, which are the structures that harbor the DNA, and it sort of gave us like a straight line of A's, G's, and T's. But what we know is that's not how our species is if we look at it at a population level, because there is so much variation between each of us. And that statistic that you used earlier where you said, you know, each of us is 99.4% the same. And it is that 0.6%, which is really very interesting and often, you know, gives us information about our origins. So that's part of the population genetics, but it also gives us information about, you know, whether we are more susceptible to disease or not. So, you know, I think this pan genome reference paper that was published on the 10th of May is really extraordinary because it no longer is the information just on a single person or one person, you know, that sort of linear representation, but it includes information from people from different backgrounds and different ancestries. So those 47 people were chosen very carefully to make sure that we captured more of the variation that occurs across the globe.
There was somebody who was an Inuit, and then there was somebody from Patagonia, and there was somebody from the Iturbi forest and maybe Mongolia and something like that.
Yes, it was a very diverse group, and there was a lot of interest in how it was chosen. And we also had conversations about that here in South Africa, because we are part of another initiative which is now looking at including more of the diversity of Africa in this pan genome. Because at the moment, it represents West Africa, East Africa, but not really South Africa. And we feel that that is a huge gap, and we need to look at what is happening here and in other parts of Africa as well.
This project that we're talking about, this Pan Genome Project, how long did it actually take to get to this point, and how many people were involved in it? I assume it was researchers in various parts of the world that had one or another pieces of this pie.
It's also important to understand that a project like this doesn't start out of the blue, that it sort of builds on a lot of research that has been done over many decades. So, you know, as I said, the Human Genome Project was in a major initiative that cost about $3 billion to do that very first genome. And that was published in 2003. But it wasn't the entire genome. It had lots of gaps in it. So, I think it was about 2017 that they decided that they wanted to do this human pan genome effort, which was really capturing much more of the complexity. And about 2 years ago, they published for the very first time what we call a telomere to telomere genome, which is literally every single base, which are those A, G, C's, and T's of a particular genome from one end to the other. So it took about 17 years to actually get from that very first draft to this final genome. And then they used that information and the techniques that they learned and the very complex computational algorithms to actually now build this pan genome. So it took the efforts of many scientists across different parts of the world. But, you know, it was coordinated centrally and funded through the U.S., and this now becomes a reference and a resource for geneticists everywhere in the world.
Now, my assumption is, I hope I'm right, that the outcomes of this research are essentially freely available to all researchers in the field who want access to it because it's stored out there somewhere in the cloud, and anybody with enough computer power and an interest can download it and work with it to figure out why I have brown hair and somebody else has.
So, Brooks, I think, you know, you raise a really interesting point there, because we often talk about, you know, what is open data? And open data is something that everybody has access to. And there are a lot of ethical issues around human genomes, because information about the genome tells you something about a person. Or, you know, does it make sense for it to be completely open? And are you protecting your participant sufficiently? So, interestingly enough, that the PAN genome is open to everybody. And, you know, although it is built initially on the genomes of 47 people, it will eventually include information about a lot more people. But it's broken down into little blocks so that you can't actually say, you know, this is the sequence of a particular person. So when we think, I'd like to explain a little bit about the PAN genome, because, you know, we say that people are 99.4% the same. So there are regions of the genome where there is very little variation or differences between people. So those areas are fairly straightforward, but then you get to another bit where there's a lot of variation. And what they do in the PAN genome is that they layer on, you know, the variants so that it has more information. And what they do is they also attach information to the layers to say, you know, this particular form is more common in Africa or in people from Asia. You know, so I think that's really important. So one of the ways people have been explaining this is to use the analogy of a map. If you can think about, you know, if you're going from Johannesburg to Cape Town, you can take the major roads, and that's just a single road. And that is what we used to have, that linear map. Now with the PAN genome, you can take as many routes as you want, and you can make detours, and the detours will give you more information. So those detours are the variants or the differences that we see in the genomes between people. So you can appreciate this richness, you know, just going from a highway to this meandering path, which gives you so much more information.
We're going to take a brief break, and we're speaking to Michelle Ramsey, noted scientist, researcher on genetics based at the University of Witwatersrand, and we're talking about the PAN Genome Project, which is recently been announced. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we're back. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and it's a pleasure to be speaking with Dr. Michelle Ramsey, noted by, her title is so long, I'm simply going to say noted researcher at Wits University and someone deeply involved in the PAN Genome Project. And we thought she would help us understand what's going on. Now, as we were talking just before the break, you were describing the precautions that have been taken so that John or Bill or Sipo's genetic makeup can't be accessed by anybody in its entirety. And that is actually an interesting, do I own my genetic makeup, or is it something that is free, sort of open game for any researcher with the ability to use it, or is it mine? And I'm thinking of the case in particular of the woman in New Jersey many, many years ago whose cells became the mother cells for all the stem cells that were being used for a whole range of research. And she was never recognized nor compensated nor even acknowledged as the progenitor of this biological material. Is this my genome, or is it yours and anybody else who wants it? And how do I stop you from having access to it, I guess?
I think that's a great question. And Henrietta Lacks never had a chance to give informed consent for the use of her cells. And I think, you know, for me, it's all about choice. And that people should be able to choose whether they want to make their data freely available or not. And we have in South Africa now this Protection of Personal Information Act, often referred to as POPIA. And, you know, we need to be cautious about putting data very openly in the public domain. So as I said, you know, when we think about the research that we do, It always starts off with a conversation, and we stress the importance of community engagement or individual engagement to ensure that people fully understand what's going to happen. You know, is your data going to be open? Can it be shared with others? You know, who does it belong to? So I think they're really, really great questions. And we are struggling in many ways to address that issue because DNA is uniquely identifying. You are unique in terms of your DNA sequence. Identical twins have the same genome, but each one of us, of the 7 billion people on Earth, have a different genome.
When I go to this website, wherever this is, and I download all 6 billion pairs of links, it doesn't say, this is John's genome. This just says genome number 15 or something like that.
Yeah, so we'll have a DNA sequence, and it will probably say, you know, this particular sequence has a frequency of roughly 20% in Africans, but only 1% in people from European origin. So it will give you that kind of information. And you know, what is so important, Brooks, is to have these references that everybody in the entire world uses. Because if somebody is in Australia and they have a patient who has a particular disease and they sequence the genome of that particular patient and they find something which they think is the cause of the disease, mm-hmm. they need to be able to tell the world what it is. So they have to say it's on this chromosome at this address and the variant is taking you from a G to an A. And if that person has a family member in South Africa or in London, you know, they can send a report that says that and everybody will immediately understand what they mean. So it's really about a detailed map.
You sort of preempted one of the questions I wanted to ask. What practical use is it? And you started down that path already. But there's a second side to that, for me at least, or an alternative question. How can we be so sure on the basis of 47 people that this is the entirety of diversity? There are several billion people on the planet, and if each of them has a slightly different genetic makeup, is 47 statistically sufficient, or does there need to be a whole lot more inclusion? Are we all going to have to get tagged eventually for this?
Yes, I don't think we're ever going to be able to put everybody on there, but what we definitely need to do is to increase the diversity. And, you know, in the series of papers that have now been published by this pan-genome effort, they've said that by next year they want to have 320 people's sequences represented. And we're working in parallel on generating sequence data from people across the African continent to mm-hmm. contribute to this effort. What we know is every time we sequence an African genome, we find dozens, hundreds of novel variants. In 2020, we published a paper where we looked at the sequences of just over 100 African individuals, and we identified 3.4 million variants that had never been described or published by anybody in the world. And this is the beauty about working in Africa, is that we know we will discover something new every time we sequence a genome. So if you think of the genome, yeah, it's huge. It's
sorry, I had to mean to cross conversation there. I was going to say Pliny was right after all, wasn't he? There's always something new out of Africa.
And that is so true for genetics. Absolutely.
Let me see if I understand this correctly. And you straighten me out if I don't understand this. This is the genetic sequencing of the genes in the nucleus of a cell. But there is in all of us a second repository of genetic material in the mitochondria of the cells, the sort of the energy generators, if you will, and their genetic material, regardless of where it ultimately came from, whether it was bacteria that fused to an early cell or whatever. Is that part of this too, or is that something that is yet to be determined, or doesn't it matter for these purposes?
So when we think about the human genome, it's the nuclear genome plus the mitochondrial genome. So the difference in size is huge. Like the mitochondrial genome is only 16,000 bases, whereas the human genome is 3,000 million bases. So you can see, you know, there's much more variation, much more information in the entire genome. But the mitochondria have been really interesting to study. And, you know, you referred right at the beginning to the mitochondrial Eve, and the mitochondria are those organelles in our cells, the powerhouses, as you say. And the way that they are inherited is very interesting, because a mother will give it to all her children, male and female, but only her daughters will give it to their children. So when you look at the mitochondrial DNA, you're looking at a uniquely female lineage. So I would be looking at my mother and her mother and her mother's mother. And your mitochondria would be your mother's and her mother's and her mother's mother's. So you can see that it's restricted in terms of what it tells us about our origins. But nonetheless, you know, it's a fascinating molecule to study, and it tells us a lot about, you know, where we likely come from, because we know that there are different patterns of distributions of mitochondrial DNA across the globe.
And that leads me to a question I think we both sort of hinted at, that Africa has, because of evolutionary processes, there's more variation among African populations writ large than all of the other populations on the planet, because there's simply been longer periods of time to evolve that way. I'm brutally simplifying this, but what that means is that if you're a Mongolian and a Patagonian Aboriginal inhabitant, you are more closely related genetically than, say, two very different people on this continent. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely fair to say, Brooks. So, you know, we say that Africa is the cradle of humankind. And what we mean there is that this is where anatomically modern man emerged about 200,000 years ago. And that about 70,000 years ago, outmigration from the continent happened. And the groups of people who outmigrated didn't take all of the genetic variation from the continent with them. They took a subset of the variation. And that is why in the rest of the world, it's only a subset of what is in Africa. But what we have to remember is that over 70,000 years, new mutations occur all the time. So you will sometimes find variants that are unique to Europe or Asia that are not in Africa. But of course, Africa has had so much time to accumulate more mutations that the populations here, without a doubt, and this has been shown with so much research that we've done, have just orders of magnitude more variation than we see in the rest of the world.
We have to take a brief break, and we're speaking to Dr. Michelle Ramsey, who knows everything there is to know, apparently, about the Pangenome Project, and she's busy explaining it to us. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector. We'll be back in just a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we're back, and this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're talking with Michelle Ramsey of Wits University, and we're talking about the Pangenome Project, where scientists now know everything there is to know about all of us and all the diseases we may possibly generate. That's an over-exaggeration. But I want to raise the really freighted question of race, because people are always talking about race, not the Indianapolis 500, but genetic differences between this group of people and that group of people. Does this process, this Pangenome Project, what does it tell us about the truth or lack thereof of different human races?
So, you know, when we think about race and ethnicity, those are essentially sort of cultural constructs. They don't really refer to genetics and biology. So what is really important is to remember that we are one species, and that essentially each one of us is 99.4, some people would say 99.9% the same. So the similarities far outweigh the differences. When we look, you know, at groups of people in Africa, compare them to people in Europe and Asia, we do see genetic differences. But really, geneticists are moving away from using labels like race. So we have a lot of conversations, because I think what we still do now, and doctors do this often, is we use race as a proxy for, you know, certain diseases. So people would have said in the past that cystic fibrosis doesn't occur in people from Africa. You know, so if they have a patient and the patient has symptoms that suggests that it may be a diagnosis of cystic fibrosis, they wouldn't even entertain it because they learned 20 years ago or more years ago that Africans didn't have cystic fibrosis. But we know now that that's not true, that they do. So we have to be very careful about using race as a proxy for a group that have a certain attribute. A field that we call pharmacogenomics, which is really about the way that we respond to drugs. You know, so we know that some of that response, so if you have 100 people with hypertension, for example, many of them will respond to a diuretic, the first kind of drug that you might give them, but some of them may not, and they would need a second drug or a different drug. And often whether you respond or not can be determined in part by genetic variation that you have. So we know that those variants don't always occur at the same frequency in different groups of people. So it's important to do the research and understand that, because it may influence what you put on the essential drug list in a particular country or for a particular group of people, because you want to, in your essential drug list, make sure that you treat the most or the majority of the people for a good outcome. And sometimes it would mean in one country that, you know, the hypertensive drug would be one thing, and another country it might be another, because of the attributes of the population. So we don't want to necessarily label it by race, but you can say that there are some differences which are more common or less common in a particular group, and that can sometimes guide how you start your treatment.
And so this study and this process and this repository of data can help enormously in evaluating this information for which drug works best in which circumstance and with which group. Is that how I should read this?
Mm. So I think in part it can help us understand that better. You know, what we're moving now towards what we call this era of precision medicine. Mm. Mm. And, you know, in many ways, you know, we've been doing little bits of precision medicine for a very long time, but not really for common diseases. And what the pangenome can help us do is that when we approach a patient with an unusual diagnosis and we want to sequence their entire genome to look for variants that may be associated with disease, we would then go and sequence the whole genome and then match it to the pangenome. Now, before we had the pangenome, our matching would not always be very good because we only had one version. Mm-hmm. Now we've got lots of versions. So you can do much better matching, or annealing, we call it, to the genome. And therefore you will have data that is much more accurate. And if you then have research which tells you about drug response, then you will get the information. So I think what's really important is to say, you know, that at the moment when we sequence, the techniques are good, but they're not perfect. And sometimes we miss things, and the pangenome will help us to catch more and see more in the genome.
And that, I guess, is reflected in what I have read about, in your term, precision medicine, with dealing with things like cancer, in which a person's particular genetic makeup dictates which precise mixture or magic bullet, shall we, will be used, and in what frequency and in what amount and how and under what circumstances, in a way which just 5 years ago was almost unimaginable.
So Brooks, cancer is also a very interesting case, because it is often the result of mutations that occur in what we call somatic cells, like if it's breast cancer, in the breast cells or in the gut lining, you know, that sort of thing. So again, you want to understand what genetic mutations have characterized this particular cancer. And that will then enable you, as you say, to find out what is the best treatment suited to address the cancers. So those mutations and differences are often not carried on to the next generation, because they don't occur in the constitutional makeup or the genome of that person. They occur in specific cell lineages. But this is all part of precision medicine, because what you can do is you can, you know, take a biopsy from the cancer and then look at the cancer and the mutations that it has accumulated. And that then guides your therapy. So, you know, you spot on. Precision medicine is complicated and individualistic, and is not only about genetics, but also about, you know, other physiological processes and data and, that will help inform it.
I had the privilege, 20 some years ago, of meeting Craig Venter and Francis Collins in the U.S. Collins with, I think it was then the National Institutes of Health or National Cancer Institute, I can't remember which. And Venter was an entrepreneur and he had his own company and he was doing this stuff and he was quite a showman. And he, in fact, I think it was originally from here, from South Africa, if I'm not mistaken. And the two projects were just at the beginning of this. And now it's almost as if it's accepted that this will happen. And you have this network of, I presume, hundreds of researchers around the world all engaged in this. This is a real sea change in the way biological research is taking place. I should read it that way, yes?
I think we've lived through an extraordinary age, which is, you know, going right from recombinant DNA technology starting in the 1970s. That's not so long ago. Hmm. You know, to having the first human genome in 2003 to where we are now. Interestingly, you know, Francis Collins was the director of the National Institutes of Health for many years, but at the time that the human genome was being done, he was the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute within the National Institutes of Health. But he's still very active. And in fact, we had the International Congress of Human Genetics in Cape Town in February this year, and he was our opening plenary speaker. And, you know, he spoke about many things, including how far we've come in terms of understanding human genomes. But I think, you know, also understanding how far we still need to go. So I think, you know, every time we have a milestone, we celebrate and we understand what we can do. But it then poses so many more questions and things that we have to look at. For instance, now we know that the genome sequence is important, but there are chemical modifications of the DNA which influences the way that the genes are expressed. And now we need to understand them much better. You know, the DNA is folded in a cell, because if you think about, you know, one cell's DNA is like 2.5 meters long, it's probably not the right figure exactly.
It was pretty
but
thin,
it's quite
though.
Long. And that has to be folded up and to put into a nucleus of a cell. And I mean, you can't even see a cell with your naked eye. So you can imagine how complicated that folding is. And what we're realizing now is in cancer, in many diseases, the folding is important, like everything that holds that ball of DNA together. Mm. So we're learning that there's so many more layers that we need to understand. And eventually we will have so much more information, because there's another scientific initiative, which is to look at single cells. And try and really understand, you know, the single cells, the arrangement of the DNA in the nucleus, the way that it then, you know, activates some genes and switches others off. And all of this is important for the functioning of the cell, functioning of the organ, you know, which is often the level at which you see disease. And then, of course, of the organism.
Something years and years and years ago, I guess, maybe back in Gregor Mendel's time, perhaps even, there was, well, he didn't know about genes, I guess. There was always an assumption that every bit of DNA in a cell had a function. It did something, made something, stopped something, started something. And now, as I understand it, there are whole sections that apparently don't do anything. They're just there and, you know, or they're lazy or something. I mean, but they don't seem to carry out body cellular functions.
Yeah.
Is that being taken into account too?
So we've learned so much, you know, when we first sort of talked about the Human Genome Project and sequencing the entire genome, we knew that there are roughly about 24,000 genes, and they make up only 1.5% of the entire genome. And there was a school of thought that said, well, we only have to sequence those bits because they're the business side of the genome. And then others were saying, no, 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 we've got to do the whole genome. And what we've realized now is that all those pieces of DNA in between what we call the protein coding genes are actually important. You know, probably not all of them, but many of them. And what we're realizing is that, you know, sort of 98.5% of the genome actually has a function. And a lot of that function is regulating the ways that the genes are expressed. I often think about it as like an orchestra. If you think about your full orchestra being all the genes in your genome, but if they all played at the same time, you'd have this cacophony of noise. it wouldn't be beautifully orchestrated in terms of an opera. So you need certain groups of genes to be switched on at certain times that will then make a retinal cell or a muscle cell or a bone cell, because it's the same genome, but they're different types of cells because of the genes that are actually expressed. And the regulation of those genes and their expression is often done by those other pieces of DNA that we previously sort of referred to as junk.
So the junk has a purpose. Let me ask one last question before we let you go back to important work. And what this all says to me is that somewhere, someday, we're going to be making bits and pieces of replacement parts for our body that are precisely suited to fit in. My cornea went funny, and so we have to get a new one, and we go to the cornea store and they dial up my genome and they make a cornea. And I come back in 2 weeks and there it is. Are we even in that neighborhood of things, or is that still science fiction?
So there's a whole body of research actually into organoids, and organoids are when you build little organs. I think, we didn't even touch on the issue of, sort of gene therapy or gene editing. No. But what is very important is that we have in our body what we call stem cells. And stem cells are those cells which haven't fully what we call differentiated. So you can stimulate them with certain growth hormones to encourage them to become a certain organ, like a piece of liver. Mm-hmm. Or a piece of bone, that sort of thing. So definitely not science fiction. So the science fiction is tomorrow's reality, but some of it is already today's reality. And I think, just understanding that, and that would be a wonderful subject for another science chat at some stage.
We're going to have to do that second chat, because we're going to take a brief break and then we'll come back and we'll let you sum up quickly as to where we are and where we're going and why it matters. This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Michelle Ramsey of Wits University on a topic which is just too fascinating for words, I guess. And we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with Dr. Michelle Ramsey of Wits University with an extraordinary title, all kinds of biological research issues, and we've been talking about the Pan Genome Project and much else. And in the next minute or so, if you might, just where we are and what are the markers to look for next? What's the next road sign that we're going to see?
Thank you, Brooke. So I certainly am very excited about the publishing of the Pan Human Genome. And this is a landmark for us because it provides us with information that we can now use to have a much finer view of the human genome. I think it's important for geneticists across the globe in terms of improving the way that we look at genetic variation and how we can start capturing more variation from more populations across the world, knowing that we have to focus on African genomes because they have the greatest diversity of all populations. So this is important, not only from a research perspective, but also from a medical perspective in terms of understanding better what the genetic contribution is to many types of diseases. So where is this going? In many ways, we still have so much to learn in terms of how genetic variation relates to our phenotype or our disease. And I think, this is part of the puzzle that will help us understand that relationship much better, and also understanding that many diseases are not only because of genetic susceptibility, but because of the environment. So it is about looking at gene-environment interactions and understanding those best for the context in which you are looking at populations and individuals.
Michelle Ramsey, this has been fascinating. We will take you up on this, and we will have a second conversation on everything else, all the rest of the cabbages and kings out there. Michelle Ramsey has been our guest today, and she is the director of the Wits University Sydney Brenner Institute for Molecular Bioscience. She's a professor in human genetics and the South African research chair in genomics and bioinformatics of African populations. How do you have the time to do all that?
It's a wonderful field to be in. I feel so privileged to have lived through this time of change from not having a genome to being able to look at people's entire genomes.
You must wake up every morning and go to work and say, I want to get started on this. I need to do some more. I envy you. That's where we should all be at the forefront of something that is just changing as we watch.
And the wonderful thing that I get to do, Brooks, is to work with young people who are so much smarter than I am. And so bioinformaticists have my full respect because our data is so big and trying to make sense of it is so complicated. I'm just so happy to work with those young people in Africa and across the world.
That's a whole universe different from my high school biology experiments, I must tell you. Chopping up flatworms to see if their RNA had any memory in it. That goes back 60 years. This is Brooke Spector and this is The Deep Dive, and we've had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Michelle Ramsey with that extraordinary title on the Pan Genome Project, and we will invite her back for another round on all the other topics that remain. And I thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much, Brooks.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we'll be back again next week with another interesting and informative and hopefully even entertaining topic. Can't tell you what it is yet, but you will be surprised. And we'll talk to you again next week at this time. Do take care.